Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It is Friday, July 9th. I have the pleasure of being joined by Real Vision's Ash Bennington and Weston Nakamura. Today, global equities surge, especially in the U.S., with industrials, financials, and materials leading the way. Perhaps those who called the death of the reflation trade were a little bit early. Ash?
Jack, I'm looking at bond markets and a new analysis of the U.S. labor market and what it means for the broader U.S. economy.
Yeah, fascinating story there. Finally, the bond market rally, which lasted 8 consecutive days, truly incredible, is over. Bond yields had gone from 1.52 on the U.S. 10-year down to 1.27 before today, surging back to 1.36. And with this, I think we have to welcome our guest, Weston Nakamura. Weston, how are you doing? How are you making sense of the let-up in bond yields today?
Hey, gentlemen, how are you doing? Thank you for having me. Happy Friday to you all. So the bond yields move this entire week has been pretty insane. And I think that it's pretty safe to say that, you know, 2 days ago when bond yields were just plummeting, and I'm talking about the 10-year U.S. Treasury or, you know, the longer end of the curve, the entire narrative shifted suddenly, you know, across the board. And then clearly, in a more of a long-term way, and clearly now that things are reversing, you're not really hearing those voices anymore. So it kind of shows how quickly people are willing to, I guess, change their outlook or their thesis. Yeah, that was one of many takeaways from the week and what today revealed.
Yeah. I've been looking at, you know, it's interesting to talk about that, Weston. You make some excellent points there. I've been thinking about a little bit of the bigger picture here before we dive too deep, too fast. We don't want anyone getting the bends here today. The bottom line is, so bonds have been rallying since about April or May, depending on where on the curve you're looking. So yields are declining. 30-year U.S. Treasury now is below 2%, I think 1.98. The 10-year is, as you say, at 1.36. So global central banks continue to signal accommodation. This is despite this sort of longer-term talk about taper. Tapering would mean that bond prices would decline as central banks unwound and yields would rise. But market participants remain dovish overall in the bond market. This is global bond markets. 60 days or so ago, we were talking about inflation fears. Where has that gone?
That is such a great point, Ash. And actually, I was reading Jared Dillian's newsletter today, and he had a great point on narrative. He writes, the narrative is changing or has changed regarding inflation. 2 months ago, all we could talk about was reflation. Now, reflation is dead, and it's being driven by the bond market. How can we have inflation when tens are 1.2%? And here's the key part. Price determines the narrative, not the other way around. When bond yields were high, everyone must have been worried about inflation because they were selling bonds, which are very sensitive to inflation. But now that bonds have been rallying and yields have declined, suddenly inflation is not a worry. Weston, is there any point to this game where we bandy around these narratives? How can you make sense of this for us?
Sure. I have a rather controversial alternate view on the Treasury yield move from, you know, this past week. If you'd like to hear it, I'm happy to share.
Yeah, well, just before we share it, I want to let everyone know that this theory was so controversial. It's kind of like dark magic. It was actually led to Weston to be kicked out of the Academy, this theory on U.S. 10-year yields. But Weston, with the caveat that this is a little bit fringe, how about you go ahead and share your theory?
Okay, let me give the caveat first. First of all, the things that I post on the exchange or that I put out there, I only say things in which I feel that there is something missed or overlooked or differentiated, because I don't like to regurgitate headlines. It doesn't add any value. So with that said, all of the reasons for, the traditional reasons such as, you know, treasury issuance and things like that, things that are well known. I'm not unaware of them. I'm very much aware of them. These are sort of additional sort of reasons for why a particular price action move might have happened. So with that said, this is my controversial view. So basically, if you take a look at the 10-year treasury yield from, you know, the beginning of the week and, you know, through today even, you'll see a precipitous drop that happened, you know, on Wednesday. Now, that drop happened aggressively right at U.S. cash open. And that's a very sort of aggressive and, you know, sort of strange move, right? Like, you know, you would ask people why are bond yields falling like this? And then people would say kind of these very generic answers, things that we already know, like things like a treasury auction. That's literally on a schedule. That did not just appear out of nowhere. The COVID variant did not just show up at you know, at cash open on Wednesday. So something happened that, you know, triggered a whole bunch of what it is a short covering from hedge funds on the treasury futures. Now, what I believe has happened is that if you take a look at the 10-year treasury yield and you look at AMC, the, you know, meme stock, AMC represents meme stocks, basically. Meme stocks just had a really bad week from about, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They just sold off. You know, AMC was down about 25%. And essentially, what I believe is that hedge funds are long meme stocks after learning their lesson to, you know, not be short them and to pay attention to them and to get involved with them. Hedge funds are long meme stocks, and AMC in particular, very heavily traded. And when you saw them start to sell off, they essentially ran to the cover of safety in the longer end of the treasury curve. And that's why you see a very, very close correlation between AMC shares and the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield. In addition to that, when you saw it turn around yesterday, midday, again, what was the reason for that? Why specifically at that time did the market turn around? Well, you'll see, again, AMC have a V-shaped recovery and the day up 6% on massive notional volume. And that coincides once again with the yield move as well. So, in addition to all the reasons that we traditionally think of, I believe that the overlooked reason is that hedge funds are involved in meme stocks. Meme stocks, you know, had a very risk-off week, and therefore you saw a flight to safety from both hedge funds who are involved in them and other institutional players who are not involved directly but are watching them and flight to safety as well.
I'm always amazed by your ability to find correlations and sort of turn over the stones that a lot of people totally miss. I want to say, Weston, are you assuming that the hedge funds are long AMC? Because shorting AMC, or actually shorting the volatility of AMC, since AMC, you know, made a high of what 70 or something, it's been a pretty good trade over the past month and a half. So, you know, what makes you think that there aren't hedge funds who are short volatility, short AMC, who would want to buy bonds too?
That's certainly possible. If you're a hedge fund that is shorting AMC, I mean, I don't know how that's. I don't know how, like, any risk officer would allow that after January. I think that there are retail at shorts AMC and all that too. But you know, what we saw after January was hedge funds, long short hedge funds, closing out their short positions, either if they're long short market neutral or if they're just outright short. And then you start seeing this whole institutional framework just kind of, you know, evolve into this, you know, we have to pay attention to Wall Street Bets. We have to have quants on top of that. We need to, you know, reformulate our strategy. We are going to go, you know, long single stock, short the index and things of that nature. And then I'll take you to specifically the beginning of June is when AMC really took off. That first week of June, you saw about $1 trillion notional in AMC options trade in 1 week. That is a lot. That is certainly nothing to brush off. Yes, retail. I mean, there are millions of them, and yes, they are using leveraged products like like options contracts representing 100 shares each. And yes, like all of that. However, $1 trillion notional turnover in 1 week. Yeah, there's hedge funds involved in that. And frankly, hedge funds are not in their. This is not their realm. So they don't. They're very insecure. They don't know They don't feel comfortable. So when they're long and then it starts selling off, I mean, it's kind of a last in first out portfolio sort of thing, and they're gonna rush for the safety of treasuries.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. Hey, can I jump in there as well, Jack? Yeah. This is really interesting. As Weston mentioned, $1 trillion, citing that notional amount on the derivatives on this stock, the underlying market capitalization is like $24 billion. So this is completely unmoored from the actual cash markets that we see in the underlying equity. You know, one of the interesting things about this, it's easy to get caught up in the casino aspect of this. I was sort of chuckling when you said risk officer. I wouldn't want to have been the risk officer at Melvin Capital. But look, big picture here, what are these meme stocks all about, and what does it really mean for what's happening in the broader economy and how investors or traders are looking at markets? There's a story in today's Wall Street Journal. I think it's something about the meme stock fantasy effect. They talk about the Tinkerbell effect, the idea that things exist because people believe they do. If you look at AMC, this was a stock in 2020 that looked like it was heading for bankruptcy, obviously on the COVID lockdown. It became a meme. It's now 100 times higher than it was at its lows. The company has been able to profit from this meme mania by issuing more stock. The consensus for earnings on this company, according to the Wall Street Journal article I read this morning, are now 30% lower than they were 12 months ago. But how is this stock being priced? It's a terrible business. Barry Diller was out over the weekend talking about how this is a guy who ran two movie studios, I should add, in the 90s. And he's talking about how the movie business, as we once knew it, is now completely over. And the AMC is out there looking for acquisition candidates. I mean, doesn't this just seem a little bit unmoored from reality when we start thinking about the fundamentals here?
Absolutely. And that's why I think that it is a good idea to short the stock if you do it in a very smart way. Or it could be a compelling reason. I think that you should never short a stock where you have uncapped exposure, where if it gaps from 50 to 150, you go bankrupt. But I think that through, selling some call spreads, you can get exposure to very richly valued parts of the SKU structure, where you're being paid a lot of money for something that's unlikely to happen. And, you know, Ash, when I look at the chart of AMC, let's take a year-to-date chart, I see one thing: exhaustion. One word comes to mind, I should say, and that is exhaustion. I think it started at, its peak was what, 70, 74, and now it's in its 40s. And if Weston's right and the hedge funds are getting into it, then why is the stock going down? Are the retail people selling? I think Jim Cramer could have been onto something when he said that all of these meme stock people on Wall Street Bets were getting diverted from their interests. They were getting involved in Wish. They were getting involved in Wendy's. And, you know, they really didn't have the fervent faith that you need of like, oh, the GameStop is the one true faith. I would make a comparison to crypto. Like, I think that when people get more involved in alternative coins, and I'm not talking Ethereum here, then that sort of, weakens the faith of the Bitcoin, which could be stronger. Ash, you have something to say on that?
Well, I guess I would probably just say it's hard to believe that the exhibitor business, the movie theater business, is something that's primed for 100x, 1000x growth. I mean, when we talk about the digital asset markets, we talk about the crypto markets, obviously we know there's a great deal of risk there. It's a speculative trade. But with that said, people are looking at this thinking about where are the payment rails going to be in the future? How are we going to do digital store of value? I mean, these are really big philosophical questions. I look at the movie exhibitor business and I go, this is something that's in secular decline. I mean, how many 20-somethings do you know who just can't wait to go out and buy a $14 movie ticket in Manhattan?
I will say I was at the office late last night with a colleague of ours, David, and he's a video editor, and he actually went to the movie theater that night. So they do exist, but Ash, I will totally cede your point. You're absolutely right that digital assets is a huge growth market, and the movie exhibitor business is not. And I wonder to what degree people can justify the valuation of AMC when its competitors, such as Cinemark and the other companies that have Cine in them, are trading for a song. Weston, let's move on. I know you have a trade regarding the NASDAQ, the Qs, and maybe short something else. What's going on there? Tell us about that.
Sure. It's actually not a particularly long NASDAQ trade. I had to fill some big shoes also on Tuesday for the daily briefing when I stepped in for Tony Greer. And at that time, I brought up a trade idea that I've been looking at, which is basically to short China tech, given the a lot of the activity that's happening with the Chinese government coming down very hard on the on their tech giants, and so the idea being that I personally am not somebody who outright just naked shorts anything. I think it's very dangerous, and even if it's guaranteed to go down to zero, a capped upside and an unlimited downside risk reward is not compelling for me. That said, what you can do is there is an ETF by Invesco who also does QQQ, and it's CQQQ, which is the Chinese, it's an index of Chinese stocks. These are the very stocks that are getting hit right now by China, especially, even today. Every day you just get more and more headlines of escalating sort of tensions between the United States and China, and then China within itself and on its own, tech industry. So you do a market neutral pair trade in which you go short QQQ, and then you take those proceeds from which you receive from when you short, and then you go for the same dollar amount and you fund a long QQQ position. And that way you're market neutral. You're basically your out-of-pocket cost is neutralized at zero minus fees and all that kind of thing, and borrow. And then at the same time, you're also kind of directionally neutral, right? And we saw a perfect example of this where market crashed yesterday, and yeah, your long Q's position fell, but the CQQQ position fell even more, which would be a positive for your short. And so this pair trade actually, from its February bottom. If you were just long just the Qs, you would basically be up somewhere around 8, 9, 10%, somewhere around there. If you were also simultaneously short CQQQ, again, at zero cost, the return would be somewhere around 50, 55%, which is a massive difference with less volatility, with less capital outlay. And it's a way to maintain upside in US tech while playing the sort of bigger theme of this Chinese regulatory clampdown on Chinese tech.
You did a good job of selling that trade, Weston. I'm almost convinced. I will point out though, you say that you worry about the dangers of uncapped exposure, and I of course agree. I think shorting something and being exposed to infinite losses is a bad proposition. But I might say that if you short CQQQ, the Chinese tech, and you go long QQQ, you're assuming that they have some sort of correlation whereby if Chinese tech goes up 10%, then the NASDAQ will go up 8% as well. So you cover your losses to some degree. And I think that, you may show me a chart of CQQ and QQQ over them, and they might exactly match. I can't tell which line is which. But if that correlation doesn't hold, then that trade will blow up in your face, especially if you get levered. And I think of long-term capital management, who noticed, they said, hey, these 30-year bonds, when they're issued, are trading at a premium, whereas the 29-year bonds are cheap. So I know what I'll do. I'll buy 29-year bonds and I'll short the 30-year bonds. Oh, wait, this is a good trade. I'll lever myself up 100 times. And they make these assumptions that the, you know, the divergence can never go worse. So I think that there are some risks to that trade. Ash, do you think I'm being unfair?
I think there's risk, and in any sort of complex trade, particularly things that have the potential for unbounded upside, I would add, in the case of LTCM, their hedge was they were shorting ruble, and the Russian banks closed their ruble window and said, sorry, guys, can't swap out. That's why they got hammered. Their hedge blew up. Very complicated position, obviously, overseas, subject to foreign jurisdiction, and not a good time to be one of the two Nobel laureates at that fund.
Yeah, I just want to be clear. By no means am I saying this is a riskless trade. There is no such thing at all. The trade can blow up in a million ways. So right now, Chinese tech stocks are the cheapest tech stocks in the world. Looks like a lot of bad news is priced in. None of the bad news is priced in the United States. And if the U.S. regulators start coming down and Chinese regulators have not necessarily let up, but that's already priced in, you can get your short position to rally, and you can get the queues to drop, and you can get torn up in you know, the other way around. Of course, there's that risk. This is not a trade forever. This is not something that you just leave a market neutral, you know, long short pair into your IRA or anything like that. But this is just a way in which you can look at it as enhancing a long sort of, you know, indexed tech position exposure, or you can look at it as a way to play the downside in Chinese tech without having to take single stock risk, because a lot of times these these are very headline driven on a single stock basis, and so I wouldn't want to pick and choose which Chinese single name to short, and a lot of times that you're just going to get in an indiscriminate sell from the index level anyway. So for now, this is something that I want to keep on. And these are not Russian GKs.
Yeah, right. Wes, speaking of headline driven, I know there's a story Ash has got his eye on. It's a very interesting piece from John Hilsenrath and Sarah Cambin on the Wall Street Journal. It's about the staggering amount of job openings. Ash, can you break that down for us?
Well, first, let me just say the one riskless trade that I have on is I'm long Weston Nakamura on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. But other than that's
horrible risk.
So listen, this is a really interesting story. The story is about 9 million Americans, basically, who can't find a job, while companies say that they have 9 million openings or more that they can't fill. This is an interesting situation, obviously, here. When you look at this, even from the 50,000-foot level, something seems out of balance. To bring that home, the unemployment rate, this is the U3 rate, is currently at 5.9%, pre-pandemic 3.5%. So what we're seeing now is a rise in the number of people who are out of work looking for jobs, and that there are these weird mismatches that exist in this market. Now, Hilsenrath and Cambin cite a series of different potential causes for this mismatch, workers moving, a study by ZipRecruiters that states that 55% of Americans want remote work from home, unemployment benefits. This is a controversial position. By and large, conservatives believe that extended unemployment benefits are contributing to these mismatches in the labor market. Liberals do not, by and large, believe that it generally breaks down along those party lines. We are seeing a reversal of an urbanization trend that basically dates back to like the U.S. Revolution in the 18th century. So it's an interesting story about how people are not where the jobs are. That's the surface level story, or I should say that's the story that's best demonstrated with the data set in the Wall Street Journal. John Hilsenrath is certainly smarter than I am, but he's discussing this as a frictional story. I'm questioning about whether or not we may actually be seeing structural factors in play here, specifically virtualization, technology, creating environments that are very bullish for earnings, for corporate growth, but are not necessarily favorable for labor. Long-term, 50-year declines that we've seen in the share of labor compensation in GDP. That number has gone from about 0.65% in 2000 to under 0.6% today. So this is effectively a transfer from capital, from labor to capital in terms of the share of compensation from GDP. It's really an interesting question. It reminds me of some things that Nouriel Roubini has talked about with me and elsewhere, that technology is skills biased, capital intensive, and labor saving. Technology eliminates jobs. It favors people who are educated in a way that allows them to work with the underlying technology. And it is biased in favor of companies, the Amazons of the world, the Microsofts of the world, who have tremendous amounts of capital. This is something that's still very early, obviously, in the reopening trade. But the bottom line is, right now, tremendous mismatch in the labor markets and suppression from pre-pandemic levels of employment.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Ash, when I hear of the amount of job openings there are and how it is very close to the number of people who are seeking work, I think that that gives workers power because they have their pick of the litter, so to speak. And when I think of that, I think that they can demand higher wages. And of course, Ash, what does that make you think of when you hear higher wages?
Well, it makes you think of inflation. But this is the question, right? If we were talking about this earlier, the bond market simply isn't seeing it. Stock markets, you would assume, at basically S&P, I believe, closing close to an all-time high today, if not at an all-time high, pricing in definitionally higher earnings. I don't know, man. It seems like there are all these weird sort of schizophrenic underlying aspects of the broader economy and how it's being priced in capital markets. I don't think it's time to panic yet, but it is something that we should be thinking about, something we should be digging into, and I think things that we should be talking about with people who are far smarter than I am on the Real Vision platform, on the labor economic side, talking about the bond market, talking about the inflation and reflation trade. I think it's an interesting time to be watching markets. What do you think, guys?
Weston?
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of, a few months ago, I put up a post on the exchange from a piece I wrote pre-exchange days. So I used to do a lot of sort of geopolitical risk analysis for hedge funds and all that. But I kind of just went on a stray and I wrote something, I did some research. I wrote something about basically the pre-COVID economy that everyone is striving for. This is, before the virus and everyone's saying like, oh, let's go back to, February of 2020. And I just wanted to remind everyone that wasn't really, things weren't so great for the structural reasons that you had mentioned. And I did this sort of analysis on, CEOs, who had left, this is in Q4 of 2019, who had left their positions. We had more CEOs departures than at any other time since these sort of, metrics were taken by a massive amount. And what you were seeing essentially was, on one hand, CEOs are using their corporate treasury to buy back shares. Essentially what they're saying is, our stock is undervalued here, and we believe that this is the best use of our capital, and this is what we're going to do. And on the other hand, they are selling shares from their own personal accounts of that same company because they're going to be stepping down. And you saw just this a record number of CEOs just kind of, exiting because they know that it's sort of the top, this worker to this employee to executive compensation ratio. And things of that nature too. So I think that you're certainly onto something, but I think that those who are benefiting from that system are also realizing that the pitchforks are coming and that they are essentially just, you know, trying to milk it for what it's worth now, because they'll probably realize it's not going to be like this for much longer. And this has nothing to do with politics or anything like that. This is just the way that globally, socially in developed markets, things are playing out.
Yeah, I just think that there's a lot. I think the reopening borrow and mend a little bit of a phrase from our CEO, Rao Powell. Rao Powell said the metaverse is in its infancy. I think the reopening is in its infancy. I think we have a lot more travel that can happen in the U.S. and Europe and Asia. And I think that we are only at the beginning of people going back to offices. So I think that their growth will be, the bond market is not always right. Let's just put the, and it could be wrong this time. I want to also explore, like, yes, technology has been the greatest investment over the past decade, after it was a horrible investment from 2000 to 2007. It lagged, raw materials, commodities, and the like. I think that, there is something to be said for sticking with the commodity trade and thinking, hey, a lot of copper is going to be used in these electric vehicles that we all keep hearing about. If flight demand returns to normal, oil could, go up in value, and it would be demanded a lot. So that makes me think of, I was recently spoke with Rick Rule, who is the recently departed CEO of Sprott Global, the precious metals mining company. And he said, Jack, I want to own things in the real world. So what I asked him is basically to tell me, I said, Rick, you're a very successful person. You're probably trying to safeguard your wealth. But if you were a young person like me, if you were a 25-year-old, and I said, Rick, make as much money as you can in a safe, relatively safe way in the precious metals mining world, like, what would you do? So he talked about silver miners and gave all sorts of stock advice, because he's retired from Sprott, so he's allowed to say things that he used to not be allowed to say. So he could say, oh yeah, this company, I own it, I like it. This other one, not so much. But anyway, let's watch a clip of this interview, which airs on Monday on the Essential tier. Let's take a look.
Getting myself back to natural resources, a few things to remember. They're cyclical, they're capital intensive. What that means is that bear markets usher in bull markets. And the bear markets that we went through, 2010 to 2018, was one for the record books. Really one for the record books. If bear markets usher in bull markets, the bear market that we went through was a Lollapalooza. And that kills supplies, which is what kicks in bear markets. Remember this too. 5 or 6 years from now, in raging bull market, a bull market ushers in a bear market. So don't overstay your welcome in natural resources.
So bear markets create bull markets, and bull markets create bear markets, Ash.
Yeah, it's an interesting cyclicality trade. I want to throw over to Weston, because he has some interesting insight from being on the ground in Tokyo about what's happening with the Olympics.
Right. So I've been working on. I've written a piece a few weeks ago, and I'm doing a follow up. But I basically have been very vocally warning about this upcoming major risk that I think the media is now starting to wrap their heads around, but certainly not to the extent that they should be. The Tokyo Olympics is going to be a disaster. This is not hyperbole. This is just, you're seeing headlines come out one after another, and I just want to pound the table and make this absolutely clear. It will absolutely be a disaster. It will be a disaster long after the Olympics are done. And it's really because of, it's COVID. It's COVID and the fact that they are forcing this through. There's no benefit anymore. You cannot, there are no fans that are allowed there. They just locked down Tokyo for past the Olympics. If you are an Olympian and you have trained your entire life and you finally made it to the Olympics, and then you get your gold medal and all that, and you kind of look up and you are greeted with an empty stadium, or even worse, a stadium full of half-empty seats with people who are not allowed to cheer, and just a bunch of masked domestic Japanese people. If you want to talk to your family, you have to go to your iPad that your coach is holding and say hello to them. There is no point of these Olympics. They're only going to cause a lot of harm, and they could potentially be another super spreader event that we are forcing through. So I just want to put that out there before headlines start to, front page headlines are, this is going to be all that it is. yes, in about 2 weeks' time.
And one thing I noticed is Marcus crashed on that news, crashed, I should say, you know, the decline of 2%, a big move down on for a day, but a crash implies something, you know, bigger over a period. But and that's the first time, Weston, that I've seen markets respond negatively to COVID news in quite some time. The normal thing that's been going on has been, oh, so many cases here, stock market up. So many cases here, up even higher. But anyway, we're going to have to leave it there. We have run out of time. But thank you, Weston, and thank you, Ash, for joining us. And thank you to everyone who was watching the Daily Briefing. Have a wonderful weekend.